Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, and welcome to a very random version of Bilge Pumps, because this is Bilge Pumps episode 56. We have no Jamie here, because it's an emergency one being recorded, because both me and Drac are in Jersey. And because of the joys of coming out here for research, we didn't manage to get a time where all three of us could get together. And then it's now got to Tuesday night. And this, of course, goes live on Wednesday. And we couldn't have you having no Bilge Pumps. So Jersey special.
Jersey special. You have the unusual privilege of both of us actually being in the same room, thus proving that we are not, in fact, the same person. But, of course, since this is going out by audio, you still technically have no proof of that, because we could just be one person with a very good ventriloquism act.
We're actually sitting on the same couch, so it's even more fun for the microphone to work out. And we get to work out how the microphone deals with our different voices, because we can see it in front on Audacity.
And, we've come back today from, being surrounded by shell ducks, stung by extremely powerful nettles, bitten by otters, and glared at by Andean sun bears, and that's just me.
Yeah, that was just you, literally. Most of the rest of us managed to visit the zoo and not start blood feuds with the animals.
I think I made a few powerful allies as well.
Possibly. I think the bears are on my side, though.
Yes. So today we're going to discuss two main topics, but obviously in traditional Bilge Pumps fashion, we may just go randomly off topic at some point in that time. But I think the first thing, having spent at least a day walking around various German bunkers built on the Channel Islands of all places, and discovering that the Germans spent a not insignificant portion
12%
of their entire Atlantic wall concrete budget building fortifications here.
On Jersey alone, they spent another 12% on Guernsey.
On the basis that, the Channel Islands are absolutely lovely, lovely place, lovely people.
Recommend a visit.
Not that strategically important in the grand scheme of things when it comes to World War II and invading France. So, it's great for us because some of the very best kept, most intact bunkers and observation posts of the Atlantic Wall, apart from, the ones where people occasionally try to blow them up with explosive after the war to steal all the steel inside the scrap, but it does raise a rather pertinent point for today's navies of, you might have a large number of resources, but if you don't put them in the right place, you are going to have some problems.
12% on a tiny island. I love it. But, 12... It's just...
He's been like this for about 48 hours.
Yeah.
I think we've broken
him. I was honestly in one of the fortifications looking at it and going, so not only are you spending this huge amount of your budget, but to add in more fun, to more joy, you are not putting in a standardized type of gun. You're not putting in standardized weapons in any way. So you're going to have all that logistics fun going on. And then you're going to spend even more money adding in even more guns, because that's your plan, until basically all the islands will strongly resemble a 1960s concrete tablock estate.
And at one point, they didn't get to actually carry out the plans, but they were planning on even bringing in 15-inch guns, believe it or not. So they were effectively going to turn Jersey, Guernsey and Alderney into slightly oddly looking concrete battleships, which would have been interesting, but...
Yes. There are reasons for doing things, and there are reasons for not doing things. The Germans managed to find every reason for not doing something and still do it. And this is the problem for modern defense. Yes, you have a large amount of money to spend. Are you spending in the right area? Or are you spending enough money in that area? Because, for example, this, They'd have probably been better off if they'd spent slightly less money on concrete and managed to spend a bit more money on, I don't know, standardizing weapons so they could have far more supplies for the weapons they do have.
Yeah, and when it comes to modern warfare, it does have so many bearings, because if you think about it, it can range from anything from, if you're talking about naval stuff, if you're going to have a naval air arm, whether that be land-based or carrier-based or a mixture of both, are you going to purchase three different kinds of aircraft that are all going to do the same mission, because each of them is very slightly more specialized in a particular aspect of that mission? Or are you going to reduce that down to two or even one type of aircraft that does that particular mission in order to simplify and standardize your logistics?
This, of course, comes back to the argument I always have with people who keep wanting the Royal Navy to buy weird and wonderful things for the AWACS and tanker role, and I go, no, let's stick with the Merlin and replace the Merlin. Because logistically, if you have just F-35Bs, Merlins, and Lynx as your entire free suite of aircraft, you only have three aircraft types to secure. Once you start bringing the Commando Helicopter Force aboard, you of course get Chinooks and Apaches as well. So that's now five types of aircraft you need to carry spares for. And your ships don't magically increase in size and have more storage volume. So what you're saying when you have more aircraft types is you're going to have to reduce the amount of the stores you can carry each type. And that usually means you reduce the quantity of, well, how to put it, instead of having the stores which go 1 in 100 times, you only have the ones which go 1 in 10 times, sort of thing. You reduce reduce your ability to deal with major issues when they come along, because you don't have the storage space, and then you have to fly the parts out to you, which is a logistical nightmare. So even though the Americans do like to do it with their COD aircraft, but of course the carrier on board delivery aircraft is another one that people keep imagining different types of aircraft for the Royal Navy to fulfill. And currently they're using commando transport Merlins, which makes perfect sense, because we already operate the Merlin. It's far cheaper and more sensible logistically and training-wise, and infrastructure in the land bases to support it, and all the other ways to just use the Merlin.
And even then, with the US Navy, the Greyhound is based, it has the same ancestry as the airframe they use for the E-2. So there's a certain amount of commonality. Obviously, as the E-2 has developed, they've probably drifted a little bit, but there will still be some elements of commonality between the Greyhound and the Hawkeye, which helps somewhat, rather than having a completely separate aircraft design. I mean, even, to be honest, even when it just comes down to basic stuff like where's the landing gear, what's the loading weights, where are we putting this thing once it's landed? Even just having that with the commonality to the E-2 airframe means at least people know roughly what they're handling, rather than having to learn how to handle and spot completely different aircraft type. And a lot of it comes down to scale as well. The US is a fleet that has 12, theoretically should have 12 large carrier flight decks. And so at that point, if you've got, let's say, four or five of them in operation at any one time in frontline roles, it makes sense to have a fleet of COD aircraft that are doing that role exclusively, because you've got
a large enough fleet to justify them there.
Yeah.
Instead of them being, for the Royal Navy, you would need, what, two per carrier? So you'd have four, maybe four more at home, so you'd have an 8 aircraft for your entire fleet.
So that's not even a squadron.
Whereas for the US Navy, they, let's say again, have two per carrier plus some of those at home. You end up with roughly 48. That makes more sense.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the things in British defence spending over the past 10-15 years, there have been some examples of where this has initially looked like a good idea of let's buy into a niche thing, and it's ended up actually relatively badly for them long term. I'm thinking, for example, of the Sentinel. Wonderful little Elint aircraft.
Yes.
Gave a capability they really did need, and now probably competing for shortest lived airframe career in the RAF of anything that wasn't actively trying to lawn dart its way into history, simply because the numbers war was so small, it rapidly, amongst other things, it rapidly became uneconomical to try and support this tiny, effectively, flight of specialist aircraft the minute that their specialist role became slightly less important because we weren't actively trying to fight three different wars.
If you consider what they're doing with the current P-8 fleet, the future E-7 fleet, yes, I know people are going to come back to it again, but there are differences between those 737 types. They have got these small issues. They've got slightly different cockpits and this and that. But there's also a lot more in similar, especially in the training pipeline and various other things that they can work from and they can pay off each other. That means that those fleets, rather than being necessary individual fleets, can feed off each other.
And again, it's the thing like with the Sentinel. Yeah, it needed some upgrades to remain competitive with modern systems. But again, if you've only got a handful of aircraft, you've got the baseline R&D and implementation costs of that program split across very few aircraft. So the overall unit price to upgrade comes out very high, which makes it uneconomical to do. Whereas if you have a larger aircraft that does several different functions, you can then split that cost, midlife upgrade or whatever you want to call it, across a larger fleet. And because you have that larger fleet, as you pull maybe two or three aircraft in at a time for refitting, you can still have the other aircraft out there doing something. Whereas with the Sentinel fleet, it was so tiny that even if you'd swallowed your pride and gone, right, we're paying all this money to upgrade it, you'd have had a choice of an incredibly inefficient, we're effectively going to artisan, bespoke refit one aircraft at a time, which would have taken years and cost an absolute fortune, or we're going to put them basically all in for refit at the same time, at which point we don't have a Sentinel fleet for however long it takes us to upgrade them. Which, again, it doesn't work.
Your only other option would have might have been go 2x2, but that's still not going to be much of an improvement on either of those options.
And for all its faults, the Nimrod MRA-4 program, as a concept, if not necessarily an execution, was a much better idea because it was a much larger fleet on a much larger platform that could have included all the operational capabilities of a Sentinel and could have had rolling upgrades. Now, granted, okay, reusing Comet fuselages and pretty much artisan bespoke airframes may or may not have been the world's best idea, but as I say, the concept was sound.
I think the problem comes now for the Royal Air Force with the 737 fleet is you suddenly are deciding on your airframes going forward what to do about the Voyager fleet. Do you go with a 737 again? Do you continue with Airbus? Because that gives you two separate fleets.
And this is one of the problems, isn't it? With the case of the 737-based airframes, we're buying them from the States, so of course the US stuff is going to be derived from Boeing airframes, since, you know, no one's using DC-10 airframes anymore.
No. No, we've managed to stop them doing that. It took a while, but eventually we've convinced them that it wasn't a good idea.
If you buy European, you're going to end up buying Airbus airframes.
Mm-hmm.
In an ideal world, yeah, great. In an ideal world, you'd want to take all the systems out of a P-8 and stick them in whatever A320 that's the Voyager.
Yeah.
And then you have an all A320 basically. That would be fantastic. I somehow doubt Boeing's going to want you to do that though. I mean, there is
a
Boeing part of it.
It's going to be decided by the most expensive aircraft in the fleet. And honestly, that's going to be between the Wedgetail and the Poseidon. So that's your AWACS and your maritime patrol aircraft. So then your tanker derivative is you either keep a second fleet going of different type of aircraft, or eventually when the Voyager comes up for replacement, which I think is in about 5 years, they have to renegotiate the contract, don't they?
Something like that.
It's about 5 years. I might be going off a bit wrong, but I think it is. There's going to be a case of, is this sensible for us? Is it sensible to keep a fleet of basically these aircraft going rather than go for commonality for 737s.
Yeah, and when you look at it in terms of ships as well, I mean, you can see the limits of this problem, at least where they've been dodged, even in navies as large as the US Navy, because you could, and over time people have, made arguments for kind of specialist one-off submarines to do certain roles, such as special forces insertion or something similar to that. And yet the US could have spent several billion dollars developing a highly specialized, highly effective, incredibly stealthy, one-off commando submarine platform that could only really do commando insertions and maybe had a defensive torpedo on them, but that's about it. And then they would have been faced with these, the kind of the Jersey bunker cost of,
yes,
we've got a unique thing that we have to maintain, and it's going to cost us a fortune to maintain it because it's a big asset.
And we've just sunk 12% of our budget into one little island. A lovely island, but one little island, and that means we haven't got money for the rest of the wall.
And so even for a Navy with as much money as the US Navy, they've ended up refurbishing and in some cases modifying the Seawolves, or certain members of the Seawolf class, which means they've got 90% of the capability you probably could have gotten out of a dedicated design. But, you know, the Seawolves can also turn around and play the SSN game quite happily.
And in fact, far masterly than pretty much anything else in the water.
And this is...
And let's be honest, it's a Seawolf. Probably goes astute Seawolf Virginia at the moment in terms of nastiest Western SSNs. And the only reason I'm putting the astute above there is because the latest variants of them are frankly evil.
Just ask USS New Mexico about that.
Yes.
but then the thing is, it's like no Navy gets it right 100% of the time. So we've talked about the British Armed Forces and some of the mess ups they've made there, but then you can look at the US Armed Forces, and whilst you've got the example of the Seawolves being refitted for special uses, which is great, you've also, to be perfectly frank, especially now, got the LCS program. Because, you know, people can say, well, some people can say good things about the LCS program. They do exist. I've never been a particularly great fan of it, to be perfectly honest. But when you look at the way life is shaking out for the US Navy these days, what was the LCS supposed to do?
Well, the program was actually supposed to devolve down to one hull. And you knew things were going wrong when they found they couldn't decide one hull, and they had to keep building equal numbers of both hulls.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't help, but...
Also, they call them the Freedom and Independence classes, which is just going to make them impossible to cancel, because are you cancelling freedom? Do you want to cancel our independence?
Are you asking me this question?
Yeah.
talk about
backing themselves into a USN, into their own corner, which they can't get out of.
And I mean, the thing is, even if you look away from the two hulls problem, even if you look away from the fact that half module systems were ordered before it's actually proven they worked,
and don't talk of each other,
even if all of that.
Instead of just buying Stanflex or a modifier, doing what they did with the Harrier program, buy Stanflex, modify it to suit your own needs. Do not try and recreate Stanflex more expensively from scratch.
But the thing is, even if we ignore all that, even if the LCS program had come out as a single hull with all the modules working, all singing, all dancing, one of the larger roles that the LCS was supposed to play, as the name suggests, is littoral combat. And it was designed, it was effectively, we want something to do minesweeping duties, all those little duties that you traditionally have a small, cheap class of vessel to do. And by cheap, I mean it doesn't cost you as much as a Burke.
If you consider it's what the RN's planning for the Type 32s.
And then you look at, you say you've got those missions, but those can be done by a fairly small, fairly cheap platform, all those smaller missions, not just minesweeping, but there's a whole load of small roles the LCS was supposed to do. But where most of the costs came from was this absurd, we want it to do 40 knots and basically chase down small explosive speedboats in the Persian Gulf and off the Somali coast.
Let's be honest, half the problems with the US Navy for the last 30 years can you put down to the idea that they were never going to have to fight another war at sea, they were never going to have to fight another war which they didn't choose to fight, and they were never going to have to, their main purpose in life was to be going to go close inshore to support the army and the air force in the land air battle programs that they were going to have to implement around the world in America's global policing unitary sole superpower authority role. Unfortunately, no one had bothered to read any history books at the time when they created this one, or listen to any historians who now, of course, are all far too mature to say, I told you so. Although even the historians who were only at the time in their, just starting primary school, really, so, weren't really at the point they could say, I told you so much when America made a decision, but retroactively might feel they have the right to do so.
Yeah, and this is the thing. So you're sinking money into a very small, very niche section of your overall tasks.
And they're still sinking money into it while building frigates.
And you're spending an awful lot of money in the LCS's case. And the thing is,
which they've called the Constellation class. So we have to hope these are good, because if you can't cancel independence or federation, freedom, there is no way you can cancel a Constellation class.
Yeah. And to be fair, the Constellation class look like they're going to shape up to be pretty good, albeit that they are pretty much what they should have been building for the last decade. Basically,
they're finally getting an OHP replacement.
But the thing...
aesthetic beauty of the OHP, let's be honest, there is something magical about the OHP. It looks so ugly, it's beautiful.
Yeah, but I mean... this is the fundamental problem.
That's because no ship looks more like an American ship than the OHP. It looked like it had every single component had been built by the lowest bidder.
But when it comes to the LCS, the thing is, if you look at the historical parallels for what they were trying to get it to do with this absurd "we are speedboat except 7,000 tons" role, is historically that role had been done by sloops, brigs, cutters, gunboats.
And let's be honest, sloops were governed by having a limitation top speed of 20 knots, which kind of made them cheap and cheerful.
And yeah, and this is the thing, that kind of previous coastal inshore support role had been done by large numbers, which they wanted, of cheap, fairly heavily armed vessels.
For their size.
Their whole objective was to sit there and go, we are in control of this area, and if you want control of this area, or if you want to disrupt what we're doing in this area, you have to come to us, at which point the speed issue is not so important, because the enemy
And remember, if you sink
here.
Us, our bigger buddies will come over. Because the whole point of having us cheap ships in this area is we're a tripwire. The bigger ships are out of sight over the horizon. You come and hurt us, they will come in and crush you.
And a modern gunboat, if you like, a modern gunboat can have a helicopter platform. And a helicopter platform is so much faster than even 40 knots. I mean,
both the super links,
both the Royal and US Navies have been proving this repeatedly in the Caribbean, because in the Caribbean, you have drug runners with narco boats and speed boats and even light aircraft and such. And yeah, okay, fair enough. They might not be quite as heavily armed as some of the pirates and the explosive suicide boats and everything that you possibly think about fighting in the Middle East, but they definitely want to get away from you. And, the 40 knot speed was supposed to be so you could chase things down. And you had frigates and destroyers of various stripes all happily wandering around the Caribbean. Yeah, sure, a drug smuggling boat or sub may or may not be faster than one of those ships by some margin. But then those ships just go, okay, that's fine, we'll just send a helicopter after you because you're
some
fast.
Ribs, because they're usually frickin' fast as well,
yeah,
let's be honest.
But to be honest, even if the ribs... 3-4 knots faster, or if the sea conditions are such that maybe the rib's not viable, it doesn't matter what you're doing, narco smugglers. You may be fast. You ain't 250 knots fast.
No, the helicopter will catch you and go, hello. I'd like to introduce you to my friend, the machine gun, and the winchman, and the boarding crew of Royal Marines who will be coming down to not sample your wares, but to make sure you keep your hands off them.
And so they kind of ignore all the lessons of history. You end up it's not just money, it's also time, because you spend a lot of money on the LCS program. But as
let's be honest, they save money by getting rid of sync.
But as I said a few minutes ago, you've also spent, 10 years or so between R&D and build time, building ships, which once you actually turn out to have an opponent you actually have to build a serious navy to fight, or potentially fight, because let's not get ahead of ourselves, we aren't at war yet, like, say, the Chinese Navy, hands up anybody who wants to take an LCS out to try and fight the Chinese?
Shame that cricket that was in my room last night isn't in here, tonight. It'd be kind of useful for the sound effects.
Yeah, you've got basically spent a ton of money on a bunch of craft whose primary mission, the reason for the cost, that mission basically doesn't exist anymore and probably never really existed anyway.
Because you just carried a helicopter.
And they also can't fight anyone who's actually worth fighting.
And let's be honest, if you really wanted an LCS type ship, you'd just buy another Asmussen class.
Yeah,
let's be honest. That's really what that will do. I'll do 90% of the.
I mean, if you want to go back, way back, well, say way back, probably 130 years back, you've also got the fact that there is almost a direct, at least for me, and Dr. Clark may disagree, but I think there's almost a direct parallel to this LCS style program in the third class cruiser, because I am not a fan of the third class cruiser, because the third class cruiser in a lot of ways was designed with that same kind of mission profile of coastal work, showing the flag, hunting down smaller ships, etc., etc., and designed to supplement the gunboats. And then when it came to an actual war, it turned out that third class cruisers were literally near enough useless. I mean, the third class cruiser that we gave to the Canadians ended up going over to the Pacific because they didn't even want to risk confrontation with armed German merchant liners. Perseus had the rather dishonorable pedigree of being the... Well, no, Pegasus, sorry. Had the.
We talk about the Pearl class again, right? I think that's one.
No, the Perlus class.
A Perlus class,
and
yes.
And others. But yeah, Pegasus became the questionably the last Royal Navy vessel to have to surrender in combat against a German protected cruiser, which in and of itself, in a fleet scale situation, Königsberg, would not have rated very highly at all, but was still infinitely fast, infinitely better armed, and infinitely better ranged than the poor old Pegasus, which could literally do nothing other than let itself sit there and be shot to pieces by this German cruiser. And as I said, they didn't even really want to get them facing off against armed German merchant raiders because they were literally no central fire control, little if any rangefinder capability, and a handful of 4-inch guns. I mean,
there is a reason that role kind of runs into post-World War I, the sloop.
Yeah.
It's turned into the sloop, which is a lot cheaper, and basically they're going, right then, you will be armed with 3 destroyer-type guns. You will have the ability to carry mines, deploy depth charges, or carry minesweeping gear. You will also be occasionally be used as a yacht, and you'll wander around. Your top speed will be 20 knots. We're not going to expect a lot from you, but basically, you're the presence on the station. You're something better than a gunboat in terms of seakeeping, but you're not something which we actually expect to do much more than convoy work in a wartime.
As opposed to when you're talking about something as third class, but still cruiser, where you kind of expect it to actually be able to meaningfully fight.
Because it has the phrase cruiser in it. The very specific word cruiser.
Whereas if it wasn't for their relatively short range, to be honest, by the time of World War I, a couple of particularly aggressive destroyers could probably beat most third-class cruisers in a fight.
A couple, I'm fairly sure. One particularly aggressive destroyer could probably do it.
Possibly, if we got a bit lucky. I mean, they do have torpedoes as well, which, to be honest, a third-class cruiser probably couldn't dodge because they're not exactly quick either.
They're not exactly manoeuvrable. There is nothing really that endears you other than being cute, and that's what I often describe them as. They are cute. They're not particularly viable warships, and they do become sloops. Yeah. You know, that's what takes on the role, and the sloop, frankly, fits the role far better than the third-class cruiser ever did, because it was a third-class cruiser. And because if you actually go back and call the third-class cruisers sloops, they actually then, they make sense. Mm. But the trouble is calling them cruiser doesn't work.
Yeah, and also they're, compared to a sloop, they're slightly, they're bigger without offering much more in the way of capability. And so they're, because they're third-class cruisers and they have that size, they are more expensive and entirely unsuitable for war fighting, which is pretty much where the LCS has ended up. Because let's face it, you've got the gunboats, a slightly bigger gunboat, which is what the sloop is, would have done all the stuff the third class cruiser did perfectly fine, would have been cheaper, would have been available in much greater numbers, and would have freed up some budget for some more second class cruisers, which might actually have stood a chance against anything more than a strong breeze. So it's not like the historical parallels haven't already been there.
Let's also be honest, the LCS program, and before we get too far into the LCS program, we should think about this one. They start off by basically going, this is not going to be a frigate. That's lovely, but the trouble is, the best definition you have to guide the development of ships below a certain level and size is frigate. Because the moment you've got to use that word, you suddenly have something you can compare and contrast them to. The moment you get rid of that, and that's, I think, half the trouble, because they were not frigates, there was no way that they could be compared to the OHPs and go, is this really sensible? Is this really a viable use of money?
Because then you've got, and the thing is, now you've got concerns about, you know, can the US or is the US building enough ships to build up its strength versus China? And
are they going to have to start Japanese World War II style figures?
Are we going to have the Imperial Japanese Navy back as an ally?
Well, apparently the Japanese Navy are coming back. I'm not sure if this is being picked up by the microphone because I'm completely behind the microphone.
Oh, it's you. Your voice is being picked up.
Yeah, that's half my trouble in here. But the thing is, the Japanese have just announced that, their second in command has announced that if, by the way, Taiwan gets invaded, we might have to go and help. And that's not because they really want to get involved in that fight. No one really wants to. But strategically, it's important to Japan's security. And they're worried the US Navy might just not have enough frigates. That's honestly what they're thinking.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, given that everyone is, well, most people, sensible people, are trying to put together some form of coalition in the Western Pacific, and most people who are Japan in the Western Pacific, when they hear the phrase Japanese Expeditionary Naval Force, get a kind of cultural PTSD from the last time that happened. The fact that anyone is sensibly going, looking around going at the Japanese, yeah, that might actually sound like a good idea, which on paper, militarily, yes, it is a good idea, because, you know, even if you have all the ships.
Look, put it this way, the Japan's announced it, and South Korea has not immediately announced that they are mobilizing every single ship in their fleet.
And things, don't get me wrong, on paper, even if you've got a fleet that you're entirely convinced can do the job properly, it never hurts to have more firepower. But, you know, Japan's been moving in this direction for a few years, and you look at South Korea, which, you know, from the
just announced carrier program.
Yeah, this thing, from the time of the turtle ship onwards, has not been, you know, fantastically well known for having a large navy. And South Korea is going, we want light carriers. They've even been looking at some forms of missile launching submarines. But the local history, when you have to resort to, yes, we'll have the Japanese Navy cruising around, quote-unquote, helping, given, you know, how everyone else in the area is probably going to react to that. And you can guarantee that, as I say, a completely divorced from the practicalities of it, which are quite good, you can absolutely guarantee that China, of all people, given, you know, the decade-long plus Sino-Japanese war that was going on in World War II, will play this up propaganda-wise as much as they possibly can, because, you know, you've got the semi-joke, semi-serious Cold War propaganda here of, oh no, the Russians are coming.
To be fair, that propaganda might actually work in our favour, because it might start a whole East Asian carrier race where everyone keeps racing to build carriers, which might eventually bankrupt China.
Possibly, but then the thing is, if the Chinese go, oh no, the Japanese are coming, it might start people doing an arms race, but it might also start or exacerbate divisions within various countries, and you can't rely on the current precise political makeup, because yes, you might be able to say, oh, X country's government at the moment would just say, well, you know, that's the price of doing business in the 2020s, but, you know, election cycle, three, four years down the line, someone else might come into power on a platform. Actually, we don't want the golden chrysanthemum and the rising sun off of our coastline for a second time in living memory. Thank you very much. And even if they don't completely withdraw from any kind of alliance, they might start to be, like, best case scenario, they might start to become a little bit more cagey. Worst case scenario, they might decide that between the potential issues of Chinese domination, which, let's face it, most of these countries have not suffered for
a couple of hundred years.
At least a couple of hundred years, versus the somewhat more well-known issues with Japan from 70, 80 years ago, of which, I'd say, there are...
There again, to be fair, one of my enduring things and experiences of dealing with people from East Asia, especially, but Asia in general versus people in Europe... It does seem to me that they tend to have far longer term memories for their history.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, don't get me wrong. As I say, the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force is a very capable force. It has some very nice ships. It would be incredibly useful. And no, I don't think that modern day Japan is about to try and do Greater Eastern Cove Prosperity Sphere Mark II.
Partially because they do not have the population to actually support that.
Even if some of their political groups think the last one was still a very good idea. But
you get those in every society.
There is the practical, which appeals to my engineer brain. And unfortunately, because it's the modern world, there is also the political. And from a political perspective, it's a scenario that would have been best avoided. And one of the ways it could have been best avoided would be, say, if the US Navy was actually building a credible force of frontline frigates to supplement its very credible force of frontline destroyers and cruisers for the last 10 years, instead of faffing around with a half-broken, semi-rusted, engine-eating set of mobile targets, a bunch of which they're in the process of now decommissioning. So, I think in the future, that it will be seen as a huge misstep.
I remember having a conversation a few years ago with a very smart USN officer, because I was wondering why a load of smart young USN officers were suddenly being sent to the LCS program. And he turned around to me and said, well, it's what you do. You get the kit, and then you need to work out how best to fight it. So you put the young officers in, and they will figure it out. And I was thinking, this is 3 years ago. The LCS program is about 20 years old by this point. If you haven't figured out how to fight it yet, why are you buying the thing?
And as I said, there are some positive things you can say about the LCS program. But
they show that a trimaran hull is quite cute.
Yeah, but fitting into...
Trimaran Zumwalt hull for the new new super ship?
Carry a lot of aircraft.
Carry a lot of missiles.
The thing is, it's not a program that should ever have been built for a navy that was thinking about actually fighting an oceanic war. And whether it was the US Navy or perhaps the US politicians or a combination of both that fell into the trap of thinking that the largest navy on the planet no longer had to think about seriously fighting or an actual oceanic war for dominance and control of, you know, the oceans. it's kind of been a bit of a problem.
It's basically like job interviews I've had not too long before COVID, where I was told, why are you studying naval history? There's no point. There's never going to be another war at sea.
That looks like it's going well.
7/10 of the world's world surface. God knows what percentage of the world's untapped resources. Or 95% of the world's data. 96% of the world's trade by volume of goods. All sorts of things go by sea. Yeah. It's never going to be another war. It's far too peaceful a place.
Yeah, and I mean, just to emphasize...
And to add emphasis to the thing, I am on my second 2-litre bottle of wine brew for the day, so it's really brewy time.
And, I mean, the thing is, the sea is just that vitally important. Now, of course, you're listening to a naval industry podcast, so you're probably fairly aware of that in the first place, but just to re-emphasize the point, and because it gives me another good excuse to mention the other half of my genetic heritage... Even Bolivia, not exactly the world's most military successful nation, nor exactly the world's most fearsome naval power, ever since it lost its one oceanic port in the Pacific, has been doing its damnedest to try and get it back by hook, crook, one way or the other, and to the point that now, recently, they managed to even sign a joint basing agreement with, I believe, Peru, which means that even though they didn't actually get back the port city under their own control, they can at least have an oceanic presence. Now, you know, I love Bolivia. It's full of people who are equally mad like me, and fairly inventive.
I'm surprised they haven't taken over the whole of South America, let alone the world yet, then.
Well, when it comes to military ventures, not exactly, but that's a...
This thing, they're successful. Missing you. They need you to go back and lead them.
This, I believe, is against the Geneva Convention. but, no...
We've been deployed to Jersey. The French haven't come back since we've been here.
This is true. I mean, yeah, we're here. You don't see a single French fishing trawler in St. Helier Bay. Ergo, we have anti-French repelling properties. but, no...
They're worried that we still call their navy the Royal Navy Reserve.
Let's face it, Bolivia is a country with a population of Greater London. And much as I love it, you know, they're not exactly going to set the world on fire when the mighty Bolivian Navy sails out into the Eastern Pacific. But even they want access to the sea. And it's not entirely for national pride reasons, either, probably mostly is. But it is still about commerce and trade and the ability to receive goods in an area which you can at least notionally fly your own flag over and have a degree of control over. And this is vital for... even a landlocked nation like Bolivia, and even other landlocked nations that are out there.
And some of them might have a navy, don't they?
Well, I suppose they probably have a few boats that float around the lakes, but you know, you have to be in a position of someone like Switzerland, properly landlocked and such, before the sea stops having quite as many sort of important issues arising for you. But even for someone like the Swiss or the various countries whose names end with Stan, who sit quite happily in Central Asia, or various Central African countries, etc.
To be fair, a couple of them have navies, but mostly those boats seem to float on truck flatbeds.
But like, even for those countries, whilst they may not be in a position to exercise their overall authority and fly their flag at sea, they are still reliant on the sea because large amounts of what they import comes from the sea, which is why they're usually quite annoyed when you get pirates taking shipments that would admittedly come through another country to get to them but are still headed for them, or when some random canal pilot decides to argue with the other canal pilot and wedges a gigantic container ship in the middle of the Suez Canal and thus cuts off everybody's shipping. These things affect everybody equally, so the sea is incredibly important, and pretending for a moment that no one's going to fight you for control of it is, not the world's best decision, shall we say.
Well, it's a nice idea, but it's not really practical.
No. But enough about that subject. On slightly
I'm just checking out if the Swiss have a navy, because I do think they do for some reason.
On a slightly brighter note, but also potentially, you know, related to the fact that we'd rather keep the seas open and playing to our rules, because let's face it, ultimately that is what sea control comes down to. You want the sea and the people on it to play to your rules, because presumably your rules benefit you the most. Somebody has decided that the Type 45 doesn't need a second gym.
Just before we get onto this, I would just like to tell people, whatever you do, Google search Swiss Navy. You do not want to know about
Cutlass. That is not safe for work.
Do not, whatever you do, Google Swiss Navy.
Okay. I suppose it was an untaken domain name.
I have no idea, but oh my god, no.
So yes.
Oh, that's something I didn't need to see today.
on a slightly safer for work note.
Yeah, the Type 45 destroyed.
We're losing the second gym.
Yes, they're finally turning the Type 45 into a third rate, like we've been telling them to do for about the last, since the beginning of the year at least, since the beginning of Build Trumps.
I think it was like probably within the single digit episode we were talking about.
We've been talking about it a lot since we got into the idea of using the rating system for modern escorts, and they are finally turning the Type 45s into... Well, if they actually carried their 8 harpoons as well, I suppose they would...
the upper tier of third rates at that point.
They'd be technically...
80 gun,
yeah.
So for those of you who haven't caught up with that news, because at the time of recording, this news had just come out a few hours ago, and by the time this goes live, it'll be maybe a day old. The Type 45s, as originally designed, were supposed to carry 16 Mark 41 VLS, as well as the 48 cell silver launcher.
But fitted for, not with.
Yeah, so, you know, big void space, some bright spark, well, let's have a second gym.
Which made sense. Yeah. To be honest, they didn't have that bigger gym on the ship.
I mean, on the one hand, having one gym at the back of the ship, one gym at the front of the ship, does help with, you know, getting people to and from the gym relatively quickly. On the other hand...
And it means you can run circuits between the two gyms.
Yeah, it's just, on the other hand... If you're saying, right, well, having a gym forward and a gym aft is good because people don't have to go as far to get to the gym, kind of obviates the point of having a gym.
It's kind of like my approach to the gym. I'm a member of the nearest gym, which I can drive to.
Yeah, it's like one of those things along the lines of, yes, I can understand the point of having a mini fridge and having it right next to your gaming seat is a good idea. However, the idea that having a more convenient source of sugary products is going to be of any help to your waistline is really kidding yourself.
To be fair, that is my aim, but, you know, yes.
So they didn't get the Mark 41s, but they have decided to stick in a 24-cell launcher for Sea Scepters, which are otherwise known as CAM, etc., basically the shorter-range missile.
Basically, they're putting in a mushroom farm.
Mm. So now the Type 45s will be able to carry Sea Viper, i.e. Aster 30, which will be upgraded as
to
well.
Pretty much what we would call Aster 40, but we're not allowed to call Aster 40 because no one wants to say we're changing Aster 30 because we can't get money for a new missile, we only can get money for upgrades. So it's Aster 30, plus.
So now it'll carry 48 Sea Viper, or Sea Viper 2, I guess, in its original 48-cell launcher, plus your 24 Sea Scepters, plus deck gun and COWS and
harpoons
if they decide to stick those on.
We can always hope naval strike missile. We can always hope someone finally just goes, let's buy the Norwegian. It's very nice. It's good. It makes a lot of sense. I have to say, there is part of me sitting there going, why couldn't we just fit the 16 Mark 41 VLS? Because then we could have used 6 of those to quad pack CAM, and we'd have had another 10 cells for various other things.
Yeah, or you could, just install the 16 Mark 41s, quad pack C-Scepter in all of them. And then that would be 64 missiles, which would put you up to a total of 112. Yes, 112 missiles, which would have then popped the Type 45 up to reasonably
first
serious. It was first rate and reasonably serious combatants.
Well, and add on 8 naval strike missiles, you're up to 120, and you are really looking quite cute.
Yeah, but you know, take what you can get. At least it means it's stepping up above the missile capacity of a large frigate.
Yes, and it also means, think about this, the Type 83 is going to have to step up in consideration as well.
Yes, because the Type 83, of course, is the theoretical replacement for the Type 45s in the 2030s, and the 80 designation means it's going to be a general purpose vessel, so it's supposed to be able to do the air defense role and anti-service and anti-submarine and some other roles that they'll probably stick onto it. And if the new baseline for anti-aircraft defense is a Type 45 with 72 missiles aboard, that means that in theory the Type 83 should have at least an equal, if not better, capability, which is much better news for something of that size if it's got carrying at least 72 missiles than it is if it was, if someone could say, oh yes, well, the Type 45 only has 48 missiles, so we can afford to just give it a 48 missile. And let's face it, given the bean counters in the Treasury, they probably would have just demanded lifting the 48-cell launcher out of the Type 45s as they retired and sticking them in the 83s.
To be fair, what do you think means they're not going to do that with the Type 83s anyway?
Yes, but, you know, if they've got a slightly larger design, they might actually think about putting a slightly larger, dedicated, longer length missile farm.
Because here is the point. They're going to be fitting these missiles, but it's going to be fitted between 2024 and 2030, I think. Well, some have said 2026 to 2030, and some have said 2024 to 2028. I myself cannot see the point in HMS Daring going up to Camelurds when she is supposed to, and not having it fitted to only have to go back in a couple of years later for a major rebuild to have a VLS fitted.
Yeah. And, I mean, it kind of probably puts a little bit of an indicator on the Type 83 program as well, because if the last 45 is supposed to be refitted in 2030, then there's very little point in doing that refit, only to pull it from service a couple of years later when the 83s start coming into service. So that indicates that either they're expecting the 83s to only start entering service in the latter part of the 2030s, or potentially they're looking at a Type 26 style slow rollout where you might have, for sake of argument, the first Type 83 hitting the water in 2032, 2033, replacing Daring, which might have had its refit in the mid-2020s, so you've got 7-8 years work out of it with a new format, and then over the rest of the decade, you roll in the 83s, at which point the last 45 that goes out of service, going out of service towards the end of the decade, which means even if it had its refit in 2030, you still get 7 or 8 decent years of work out.
There is another option before anyone starts jumping for engaging strategies, Leander Fred, where he points out that they spent all that money and then they only spent less than a decade in service. I agree with him, that was a bit absurd. In this case, it's going to cost $500 million, which doesn't buy you a lot else, but does give you 6 very useful ships, and there is the other option.
And it works at $80 million per ship, which is not, in these days, is not bad from mid-life upgrade.
Six ships,
$80
million. Roughly, yeah. But what it does, what the other option is, and this is something you should have to consider, might it be that they're expecting to have to increase the numbers slightly, maybe to 7 or 8 Type 83s. They're considering that as a possibility. So they might be thinking the first couple of 83s come in slowly, and it's only the third one which replaces Daring and the fourth one. So actually, Daring gets to maybe 2038, if they're rolling out slowly. If there's one coming out every couple of years, and the first one comes into service in 2034... 2036, 2038, because, again, these ships are going to have to be big, powerful ships. And the reason I'm saying there might be more is because of the other news you have going on. The Type 26 program. Now, this is going to sound strange, but one of the really interesting stories which I've been watching recently on Type 26 is that they're ahead of schedule.
I know it's British procurement and we're running ahead of schedule and potentially even under budget. Which, I mean, you know, pass me the strong whiskey.
That actually causes the government a problem because they've signed up for a certain number of years for those yards to be building ships. Because that's how British procurement works. It's a bit of a political gamble. It's basically promising those yards a number of years' worth of work. Now, you can do one of two options in that time. You can get them to build a whole another generation of OPVs. But the trouble is, I have a feeling that the OPV construction is going to be starting elsewhere because we're going to have to build some small ships at some point at the same time as we've got the Type 26 and Type 31 programs going on, which means there's going to be another yard have to be used for those. Sorry, everyone. Then there's the fact that, you know, you don't want to transfer any construction up there, which is going to go away from the Type 31 building site, which is probably going to get the Type 32s. So, your option becomes, do you have a single Type 32 built up there, which becomes expensive, because presumably the yard which is building Type 26 is going to end up being the yard which is building the Type 83. Because that's our premier escort yard.
Is it the same yard that built the 45s?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking. So.
Could always give it to Babcock. I mean, they built the QEs.
Or Camelads. Or to do something in Southampton. But the odds are, if the Type 83 is going anywhere, it's going to that yard. Which means
they'll break and then need to go back to Camelad and Plymouth to be fixed again in 2 years.
Yes, but it also means they'll have a gap. And the point is that this has already started being talked about people to me, going, what would be a good name for a ninth Type 26? What would be the next city you pick for number nine? That could be an interesting thing. They could end up getting a ninth Type 26 because the program is running to time and under budget.
Although, hilariously enough, the upgrades to the 45 probably, thankfully, rule out the idea of the 83 being a 26 hull with some upgrades, basically a Canadian surface combatant version, slightly expanded 26, because we're the best one in the world. And don't get me wrong, I really like what the Canadians have done with the 26 hull in terms of expanding it and turning it into a general purpose frigate as opposed to an anti-submarine warfare frigate. I think that's a very good idea.
Drac would like to start a one-person campaign to turn the Type 32 project into, let's build some Canadian Type 26s.
And
I can see and agree with this idea, but I have a feeling if we start doing that, we might not get the Type 83s. Yeah.
And, I mean, let's see how it all turns out. But, you know, on paper, the principle is sound. However, whilst it does make for a very good general-purpose frigate, I do not believe that it is a suitably large and powerful enough hull to either merit the Type 83 designator or to replace the Type 45s.
Or to carry the necessary equipment you need to make it a Type 83. Let's be honest. If you're talking about an airfit which is going to be 72 plus missiles, you are probably talking about her having to have VLS capacity to at least another 48 on top of that for other attempts, because if she's an 83, she's general purpose. And as much as we might love to sit there and go, but our SSN fleet provides our tactical missile attack with land attack missiles, and we have F-35Bs. We only carriers. We do have all these, but we only have two carriers. We only have a certain number of F-35Bs. We're going to get more, but we're not going to have an infinite number of them. And we only have so many astutes, and we're not building a lot more of them, especially as we're starting the SSBN program, the Dreadnought program. So it comes down to the option. You need land attack missiles. You need land attack weapons. You want hypervelocity weapons.
Possibly. I mean, if they get the railguns working.
The railguns, theoretically, the Americans have abandoned. Although, as anyone else knows, the US Navy's now abandoned, so DARPA seems to be picking up the program, which might suggest that actually the US Navy's just gone, look, this is not going to happen soon enough for us to carry on paying this bill, so hand over to the people who don't mind paying for failure because their job is to invent the future. And they know that 99 times out of 100, they'll be spectacularly wrong.
But I mean, apart from anything else, the 45s still displace more than the expanded Canadian Type 26s. and the 45s are dedicated anti-aircraft warfare units. So if you're doing a Type 83, you've got to replicate at least the 45's anti-air capability. And you're not going to do that easily on a smaller hull at all. And if you somehow manage to squeeze it in, you're certainly not going to have the spare displacement and volume left to do anti-submarine warfare, anti-surface warfare, and other forms of general purpose warfare that, you know, would grant it a true Type 83 designation moniker. So, you know, it's positive news in the short term for the Royal Navy, because the Type 45s will now actually have a decent complement of missiles, and it's probably good long-term news because it means the Type 83 will actually have to be a serious surface combatant rather than...
And it's further answers the question of, are people listening to bilge pumps? Disturbingly, they might be.
Well, yeah, you never know. One can, but hope. 25,000 ton Type 83 design.
He has the design ready to go. Just give him a call.
I literally have the design, and it's 1 meter longer than the Kiros, just to annoy the Russians.
And before we carry on this, I would just like to point out, we are recording this directly onto Audacity on my computer, and it's really funny. Every time I start speaking, the blue lines go colossal, and I am the furthest away from the microphone. Drac is right next to the microphone, and it's more calm and smaller every single time. So I hope your ears are okay. I am not speaking massively loudly or shouting, but as Drac has said, my voice can be heard by this microphone wherever in the room I am.
He is kind of the up-and-coming Brian Blessed of naval history, so...
Oh, thank you for that one.
I'm going for more of Patrick Stewart vibe.
Oh... There again, Brian Blessed might be going into space with the Russians.
Mm. Well, then we will have the final answer to, can you hear someone scream in space if it's loud enough?
Yes. Yes, you can. The entire planet listening to Brian Blessed laughing. Oh, God help us. No, it's... Look, the Type 80... The whole thing is, this money's suddenly coming in. They're suddenly winning the case. And I don't think it's because the British have suddenly noticed the Far East. I think it's because the British governments have suddenly noticed, hang on, we've actually got to start showing up. Again, it is a factor of Brexit. I know people don't like to link everything back to Brexit, but the point is, when you make a choice, and the choice was quite simple, you either went full European Union, or you were out. That was the options given. Myself, I'm surprised no one offered or suggested European Economic Area, but that might have been because they were worried that other nations might decide that they'd rather like that option as well, and would prefer that to being a union member. I don't know. But leaving that all to one side, when you're out, you then have to represent yourself even more. And one of the things you do is you have your ships turning up. And the trouble is, when a Type 45, etc., shows up at the moment in the Far East, it's lovely, it's got a lot of advanced technology, but let's be honest, it's not really up there in terms of the missile count until they get this fix.
Yeah, and to be honest, the other thing is, look back at the last 20 to 30 years of military history. There are so many things you just want to plant your face into the nearest wall over. But, at least from my perspective, a short summary of what's effectively most of my life could be summed up as, by now we've learned that no, the Russians probably aren't coming.
Although they are still going to be annoying, so we're going to have to do something about them.
Yeah, but we don't need to have, you know, four armored tank divisions in the Fulda Gap. They're not coming that far west. I mean, apart from anything else, they'd have to pick up the economic basket cases that are some of the Eastern European countries on the way, which would, you know, the Russian economy would very quickly run out of money just doing that before they even got to the German border.
I'm just thinking, actually, have they got enough fuel trucks to get them that far?
Well, and there is a very angry nation called Poland. You know, Poland may not into space, but Polish tanks will probably make very, very sure Russian tanks can into space if the Russians set foot in Poland again. So, you know, it's it's only taken a generation, but perhaps the British politicians are finally wised up to the idea that, no, we probably don't need to have tanks running around central Germany anymore.
Because, for starters, they're in the wrong place. If they need to be anywhere, it's going to be Poland, because that's where there'll be actual tank battles going on.
We no longer have a V-bomber fleet, or any kind of strategic bomber force of any description. We are down to fighters and fighter bombers and
To be fair, we're down to fighter bombers and some Eurofighters, which cannot be used as bombers. But honestly, we prefer to be there. We're only keeping around because we realised we didn't order enough Tranche 3s to do all the jobs we need them to do.
But, you know, the strategic element of the RAF is rather long gone.
The Sentinel fleet, going back to one of the beginning, was the last gasp of the strategic capability, really.
And, you know, What does that leave you with in terms of armed forces? You've got the RAF. Okay, don't get me wrong, the RAF could probably use a few more planes. But planes, generally speaking, don't cost as much as ships. Although I'm sure the American procurement system is doing its level best to try and make that happen.
Sometimes you look at the individual prices of the aircraft once they're fully kitted and the individual prices of some ships and you're going, for three of those, buy a single destroyer. That's quite worrying.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. But, you know, so between that and, again, I say, I'm not kind of, for the Navy to dominate the Army and the Air Force must suffer. But historically speaking, Britain has not had an absolutely colossal army.
They've usually had a well-trained and well-equipped army.
Yes.
Not massive, but it's had a very good equipment. And, of course, that we've been very kind. We didn't include the Ajax program in our discussions of things. The fact that despite the Ajax program and all the other programs being developed, still no point was anyone planning on replacing the FV-413 or 43.
I mean, let's face it.
I've got the number wrong again, didn't I?
FV-4 something.
Yes, it's just been around for so long.
I mean, let's face it, if we were going to start talking about the Ajax program, I'm sorry, much as I love Iron Brew, we do not have anything strong enough in this room. So we're not going to talk about that today.
No, we would need to go and find our very nice host and ask if we could raid their scotch and brandy cabinet for you alone.
We're returning to an army level that's probably more in line with historic British norms. The RAF, okay, fair enough, they've been around for just over 100 years, but, you know, a good chunk of the first half of that was taken up by world wars. So I don't think we can entirely say what a comfortable level of RAF capability is just yet. But I think it probably could use it being a little bit stronger than it is at the moment.
I think you do need broadly at least two aircraft types. And this is because of the cycle of development, because as we've been over before, by the time an aircraft gets really good and really capable, it's at pretty much the end of its airframe life. So you need sort of overlapping aircraft. So you always have one which has been in service for a while as another one's entering service. And then you replace, after that one's finished procuring, you then replace the older one with another type of aircraft. So you overlap, so you don't fall behind too much technologically. Because again, technology moves on with aircraft. And that probably means you need enough squadrons to maintain a sufficient fleet. Because again, if we go back to the earlier problems we were talking about with the Sentinels, you need enough aircraft to justify maintaining the infrastructure, the people, and the investment to upgrade it. Everything requires certain numbers. So yes, the RAF and Fleet Air Arm probably need a couple more squadrons at least.
Yeah, but what it does leave is, you know,
Prefer them to be F-35Bs because we do need some more of those.
But it leaves the Navy in a position of coming back to being the preeminent arm of the British military.
Well, I'm not sure if a preeminent is the right word, but definitely the most, how do I put this, the most visible one in terms of our global presence. Because again, and this is the other thing, I like the RAF strong, but do I want to deploy them everywhere in the world? Well, that's an air base which I have to maintain, have to pay for, and commits me to that government, which might change with the next election cycle or whatever happens. That's a problem. So, again, it's one of the interesting things that someone brought up on my Discord the other day. They were going, well, the Russians keep overflying Britain with bear bombers and all that sort of things, but that's not the same as daring turning up off Crimea, or a daring class turning up off Crimea. And, well, HMS Defender, we do love you, and you turning up off Crimea is pretty much the same, but it's the naval version. And in the nicest way, that's the option Britain has, because unless we do, and even if we did invest in a bomber fleet, you then couldn't do the same with that as you can do with a bear. Because let's be honest, a bear wandering over, no one's really that worried. They're theoretical and nuclear capable, but they send the maritime patrol variant of them. So no one's going to be accidentally shooting them down, hopefully. Whereas if, let's say, we joined the American Strategic Bomber Program, the new ones, and bought them, whatever they look like, and sent one of those over Russia.
I mean, well...
Yeah, that would be basically a declaration of war.
And also, apart from the implications, if you're going to take a B-21, if you're going to have a B-21 flying, the last thing you want to do is fly it low and slow where the Russians can get right up close and personal and have a good long look at the thing.
No, you really don't.
Whereas, you know, Type 45 ships in general, they're kind of around and rather visible, so the fact that you can fly close to them probably isn't going to tell you all that much more than what you already knew.
And they turn all the very important things off.
And ultimately...
Although I have heard they might be turning on various mobile phones which are preloaded with viruses for the Russians to scan, but
well,
I'm sure they wouldn't actually do that. No, no British would actually do such an evil and nasty thing.
I'm sorry, comrade, but you will need to transfer 24 Bitcoin to the following address if you wish for your maritime patrol aircraft pilot screen to unlock.
You have been signed up to the... to find out what the Swiss Navy means on Google.
That would be a bit of a turnaround for books, given the number of bits of infrastructure that are currently being held to ransom by various hacking groups that, honestly, Governor, are not possibly based in the motherland. But yeah, it's... I mean, the other thing is when you look at the current range of possible foes, okay, so we've said, well, the Russians aren't coming through the fourth gap. Okay, so where can the Russians remain a threat? In the air, okay, that's why you need the Air Force to remain fairly strong. And at sea, and, you know,
jokes... And possibly Norway in that sort of area is the closest to us.
Jokes about Kuznetsov aside, you know, the Russians are probably keeping her around in order to maintain their aircraft carrier operational capability until they can get around to deciding what they're going to do for a replacement. So... Navally speaking, Russia is still a potential issue, and let's not forget they do have a fairly extensive and relatively capable submarine force as well. That hasn't just gone away.
And that actually has been in recent years enjoying a lot of recapitalization, as those economists love to call it. In other words, they've been investing enough.
Yeah, they've got new submarines coming off the lines all over the place.
Which might have been in production for about 10 years, but they actually look like they're working.
And then when you look at look at elsewhere, we're on side with the Americans, so scratch them off the list of potential adversaries. The EU at the moment, for all its positives and negatives, one, we're almost certainly not going to end up more with them in the next couple of decades.
Because they're mostly all NATO allies, and that means the US is also their ally, and it would be complicated.
And also, it's the EU at the moment with the current bureaucracy. They couldn't organise a combined EU Navy to save their lives, literally.
Oh, thank good lord.
So, there's that. And then outside of that, well, there's no particular major...
Isn't there a German political party which is actually campaigning on the policy of creating an EU army?
There's probably a German political party campaigning on all sorts of things.
Yeah,
I don't actually follow German politics that much. But
it just occasionally flashes up in my Twitter feed.
But when you look across the world, you know, there's... I mean, okay, Brazil wants to be a rising power, but one, again, what the near strategic term possibilities of going to war with Brazil, of all places, are pretty remote. And compared to some of the other navies, they're also... I mean, they're big. Don't get me wrong, but they're not on the oceanic global protection level of some.
Basically,
of the other stuff.
Our threat risk comes down to Argentina if they have another government change and they turn out to be far less sane than any other one since 1982.
And that's why we built the Death Star in the Falklands.
Then you have the issues with possibly Gibraltar, but let's be honest, Spain shouldn't be that crazy. Again, they're NATO and EU. And then we have all our allies who might well suffer coercion, or worse, in Southeast Asia and South Pacific.
And when it comes down to that...
Although apparently China's offering Argentina help on the Falkland Islands now, so perhaps we should be relying on more than their stuff. Again, some more squadrons for the RAF and the RAF and Fleet Arab so they can base them down in the Falklands. More than a flight down in the Falklands, please.
But this is the thing. It's like, even if China did want to, that, how are they going to do that? By Navy. And if we do end up in some kind of armed conflict with China, well... Let's just say I wouldn't trust the lifespan of any fixed air base in range of Chinese medium-range ballistic missiles. So confronting them from an Air Force perspective is probably out, unless you're flying defensive missions from Japan. And nobody in their right mind, and most people who are not in their right mind, are ever going to think a land war in China is a very good idea.
We hope not, anyway.
So with the best will in the world... British Army, well, and actually, to be honest, literally with the best will in the world, I seriously hope no one tries to send you over to fight in China on land, because that would be...
I have a lot of respect for the British Army, but honestly, no.
I mean, it is one of the great military sayings, you don't fight a land war in Asia, and especially not in China. I mean, that level of stupidity probably would be grounds for the Queen to just step into Parliament, clonk them over the head with the Royal Mace and say, I'm in charge now, because you clearly have, you've liberated one of the two brain cells that passes for the collective resources of the British government, and you only got one, so you've developed myopia. But it means that what you boil down to is the Navy. Navy is the only remaining arm that can... pose any kind of serious opposition to a
potential, or credible deterrent
to potential Chinese expansion. And yes, there will be people, I'm sure, saying, yes, well, the Royal Navy, even if it's somewhat expanded, can't take on the Chinese Navy alone. And
no, we're not saying it can, but
that's why you have allies. And if much as I may have been watching Planet of the Apes and Planet of the Apes 2 a little bit too much recently and making a lot of terrible ape-related jokes as we wandered around the zoo, it is literally a case of apes
taken strong. We have taken a lovely picture of him with what I say must be a relative, having looked at him looking at that statue.
But no, it's a case of we are stronger together, and, if the Royal Navy is a bit stronger, and the Australian Navy is a bit stronger, and the Japanese Navy is a bit stronger, and the South Korean Navy is a bit stronger, and the Indian Navy is a bit stronger and stops crashing its aircraft, and the US Navy actually, now is building frigates and destroyers instead of glorified drinks cans, then collectively, it's a very strong deterrent.
Mm. Because it raises the threshold. And that's what you're doing. When we get back to the Type 45s, them having those 24 C-Ceptors. Yes, I would love them to have the Mark 41 VLS. I think it'd be far more sensible. And I would absolutely be overjoyed if they were loaded with, 32 C-Ceptors and 8 SM-3 anti-satellite, anti-ballistic missile system missiles, or whatever else, or even 8 Tomahawks put in there would be lovely. But 24 C-Ceptors, that's not bad.
Mm.
That gives us a lot of capability. That gives those ships a lot of viability. And that is what you're talking, and that's what you need. Now, admittedly, that they still have the Phalanx, but the good thing about having all those C-Ceptors is you probably won't need it. You hopefully won't need to use the Phalanx.
Yeah, and baby steps. We've convinced... Hopefully the Royal Navy's convinced the Treasury that, yes, we do need the C-Ceptors and the C-Vipers in reasonable numbers. So now that they've won that fight, now they can go on to the next fight, which will hopefully be convincing them to replace the Phalanx with something a bit more useful other than a very loud, soundy, probably should get to the lifeboat's notification system.
Do we go 57mm, 40mm, or 76mm?
I'm currently torn between a twin 40, or possibly just asking the Italians for a line on their 57s.
I'd go for the twin 40. You see, every time I look at the 57, I think, yes, that's a viable system, and yes, that's wonderful,
But the twin 40, the rate of fire and the possibilities of what you can get into the 40 millimeter, that's just enough bang.
My only hesitation is that if you ask the Italians, can we buy some of your 57s, you could literally just go up there with a checkbook now and get some.
Yes.
Whereas with the twin 40 will require some form of development and R&D.
Well, BAE have a twin 40, don't they?
There's a few in development, but there's none that are mature systems currently deployed on ships.
Yeah.
There's some twin 20s, but that doesn't...
That, really no, matter, no,
so.
Oh no.
So, yeah, the twin 40 would need a little bit of R&D, which A, would delay an in-service date, and B, you know, it would become an MOD for a research and procurement project, which is... Should we say, doesn't fill me with great...
Would the Italians do a twin 57?
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't think a twin 57 is going to fit where Palance currently sits, though. It'd be nice, but I don't think it'll fit.
Twin 57.
Maybe we can put those on the 31s.
Yeah, and on the 83s and the 32s. Twin 57s and twin 40s on the 31s, that would be lovely.
Resurrect the K-25 project and just replace the 5.25s with twin 57s. I mean, it'll make someone happy, mainly the manufacturers of 57mm ammunition. But, well, you never know.
Yeah, he'll be good.
In the words of Professor Farnsworth, a man can dream.
Yes.
Also, in the words of Professor Farnsworth, I can spare one Doomsday Day device and still be feared, so possibly not the world's best resource of phrases to listen to if you like, but...
Oh, it works.
Lightning does strike twice occasionally.
Yeah, Matt Groening, thanks to the Simpsons, and that has had a lot of fun. I'm trying to remember what it's called now.
Futurama,
yeah.
So, with that, considering our emergency... broadcast has now lasted about as long as our regular broadcast.
We'll say thank you
very much for listening, and just hope we don't get asked to do the emergency national broadcast system, because you'll probably still be listening to us by the time the bombs actually hit.
Or alternatively, let's hope the French stay away, because tomorrow we get to see even more guns left behind by the Germans.
And I mean, as I say, you know, like the tiger repelling rock here in Jersey, there are no French. So, you know, they might keep us around.
Yeah, they might. All right. Thank you. Take care.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.